Hello and welcome to The Big Fight. The situation in Jammu and Kashmir is one of those situations that seems to be going through an up and down cycle. There are times when it looks as if everything is under control and peace is returned and there is normalcy. And then suddenly things will happen which makes it clear that underneath the surface, it's not quite what it seems. And then there are flashpoints. You have Handwara, you have incidents like that, and then suddenly you start to get concerned about just how bad the situation is. And perhaps this is an issue that we need to continue to give attention to, because some sort of a long-lasting solution or a way of resolving the issues or the problems, so at least reducing them to acceptable levels, is something that we should all be working towards and trying to aim. So over the next hour or so, we've assembled some of the top experts in Kashmir and on Kashmir, and to try and actually find an answer to two specific issues that I think we need to turn our attention to, and which have both been highlighted to some extent by the events of recent months. Number one, what seems to be an increasing radicalization in parts of Kashmir. There used to be a certain Kashmiriyat, a certain syncretic culture, which has historically always been there in the Kashmir Valley. But increasingly, the evidence of radicalization in certain parts, you can call it Wahhabi influence, you can call it Salafist influence, but that is one set of issues that needs to be looked at. And the second, of course, is this entire question of whether you should be having the army or other elements of the security forces living in close proximity with civilians in the face of them. Should you have had a bunker in Handwara in the first place? And if not, what can be done to ensure both security is taken care of and as at the same time the rights of civilians are looked after? So a lot of issues to be looked at in Kashmir, but these two in particular are the ones that we're going to be focusing on over the next 1 hour. And to join us, our panel, Junaid Matu is joining us from Srinagar, spokesperson of the NC. Professor Hamida Naeem is also with us from there, chairperson of the Kashmir Center for Social and Development Studies. We do have Radha Kumar with us, who's a historian and interlocutor for Jammu and Kashmir, had come up with some of the possible suggestions some time back. Standing next to her, Rahul Pandita, well-known journalist, strong views on what should be done there. Suhas Chakma is with us as well, Director for Asians of the Asian Center for Human Rights. We have with us Mr. Ian Ram Mohan, former DG BSF, also looked at the CRPF, a whole range of actually paramilitary forces. I can't think of too many you haven't been associated with. So great to have your expertise. Major General J.D. Bakshi, it's always a pleasure to have you with us, one of our top defense analysts. We have Sambit Patra with us as well, spokesperson of the BJP, and Tom Vardakan representing the Congress Party. So a range of voices. As I said. All right, let me start off very quickly by first getting everyone's very brief sense of what actually is happening in the Kashmir Valley, because I sometimes find our discussions and debates on Jammu and Kashmir are slightly dominated by noise. And I've said this in the past, if you could convert anti-national separatist elements in Kashmir to loyal patriotic people by shouting at them, you know, we'd all do a lot more of it. But I think and I fear that the solution's perhaps a little bit more complex than that, and we need to find what the right answers are. So, Junaid, why don't I start with you, get a perspective right there from Srinagar. What we are seeing in the valley right now, is it more or less worrying than what has always been there? We did see 2008, there was a flare-up. 2009, there was a flare-up. 2010, obviously, was ghastly, everything that happened. Is it worse or better than that? And what I started by saying, rising levels of radicalization. Would you agree with that?
Vikram, as you said in your intro, there are these flashpoints. There is this relative period of, relative peace. And then as soon as there is a provocation, there's an instigation or an incident like we saw in the case of Handwara and Kupwara, you never know what that can spiral into. You don't know where that stops. In the case of Handwara and Kupwara, it stopped with the killing of the fifth civilian. Now the state government has recently declared to the election commission that the situation is not conducive in the state to hold elections to one of the vacated seats in South Kashmir. But I think that is political. I think the situation is not. We've seen worse. Let us put it in that way. As far as radicalization is concerned, I wouldn't completely disagree. Radicalization is a social phenomenon that we see in conflict zones. And that is where we should ask ourselves, should we continue with an operative management of the Kashmir issue, or should we look at a political resolution of the issue so that we somehow encourage an atmosphere of normalcy and liberalism in the valley? Okay. Unless the conflict goes away, unless there is a sense of resolution and redressal, things like radicalization, phenomena like radicalization, will always be there.
Okay, don't just treat it as a law and order problem, is what I think you're trying to say, and which often comes up when you're having discussions around Jammu and Kashmir. Professor Hamida Naeem, so there's a law and order and the management of that part of it, which of course is something that I do want to, and we've got some of the experts who can say how that can perhaps be managed a little better. But are you seeing a societal change taking place in Jammu and Kashmir, as some people are pointing to?
You have to come out of this law and order discourse and come to a people's discourse. And when you look at it from the people's perspective, everything is abnormal in Kashmir. Once you keep the highest military concentration in Kashmir, what could be the reaction from the public? It would lead to radicalization. I'm not sure how far radicalization has taken place, but it could be a logical outcome out of the abnormal and exceptional situation which has been created by this unprecedented concentration of army in Kashmir. You have actually tried to securitize Kashmir. You have never tried. I mean, the state has never tried to find a political resolution to the Kashmir issue. Instead, you have turned the dispute into a conflict of multiple stakeholders. And once you actually are opening a Pandora's box, you make everyone a stakeholder in a simple dispute, then it is logical that it could lead to that kind of radicalization. It is not therefore people who are responsible for any radicalization. It is the state which let us this situation to come up.
All right.
And therefore, the first thing has to be that you have to remove arm from the, first of all, from the civilian areas, because they are controlling the life and death of people. And time and again, we have seen a pattern in which army actually does take lives of people on the slightest pretext.
All right, Major General Bakshi, any time when you're having a large concentration of armed forces in a small area, cheek by jowl with civilians, you have the potential for conflict and the potential for radicalization. Would you agree with that?
Look, I think it's a very simplistic logic to say that the sole raison d'etre for the problem in Jammu and Kashmir is the presence and concentration of the army. It is just demonizing the army. I hope you understand that Kashmir is disputed territory between China and India. India and Pakistan, you take the army away, you are in fact ceding it to these other inimical states to just walk in. So I'm sure that's not a solution really. You know, the fact of the matter is, let's look for the causative. I think you are very right. Look for the causative factors. You know, I'll tell you something surprising. You have the biggest youth bulge in the whole world. You not only have problems taking place in Kashmir, you have the Jat agitation, you have the Patel Patidar agitation, you have the unrest on the campuses. Why? 483 million Indians need jobs. They have finished their educational cycles. They are now entering the job market. Your job
so
creation...
nothing to do with the army, nothing specifically to do with
down.
Kashmir. You are saying
so
that this is
have,
part of what you are going to
so
see.
So the point that I am trying to make is, it will have different regional manifestations. In Jammu and Kashmir, it will manifest itself in heightened radicalization, in greater drift towards the Intifada phase, now that the terrorists per se have been largely checked.
Okay. Professor Haim, before I come to the others, just to understand what actually you were arguing for and what Major General Bakshi said, he's saying correctly that you can't obviously take the army completely out of Jammu and Kashmir, because it is, at the end of the day, disputed territory. China's there, Pakistan's there. So what exactly are you arguing for? That the army should be removed away from civilian areas? Is that what you're saying? Or are you saying the army should be gone completely?
What I'm trying to say is that ever since, for the last so many years, decades, government of India has not taken resolute steps to address the issue. And if you won't address the issue, you are actually securitizing Kashmir, that we need army in Kashmir in order to keep away China and Pakistan. That is ridiculous. On the one hand, he is saying that the levels of militancy have come down. Whatever he is saying is a different, dominant, power-thirsty discourse. It is not the people's discourse. And I'm sorry to say, you need not get army generals to actually discuss the resolution of the issue. They are simply an agency of the government. It is the political class which has to take decisions. Army has not to dictate terms, whatever suits it. That is not that, because then there is a vested interest which has developed over the years in the security agencies also in Kashmir. What kind of role have security agencies in the civilian space? Tell me for God's sake. Even okay. In Handwara case, Army has said that we have been please. Actually
okay. General Bakshi is trying to say something
unnecessarily dragged into it.
Good. Thank you. What I am trying to tell you is we are not there for tourism. Right? We were there because in my time, 80,000 Kalashnikov rifles, 3,000 machine guns, 1,500 rocket launchers, 68,000 grenades, millions of rounds of ammunition we have recovered. How much more has been pumped in? I do hope you understand that with 80,000 Kalashnikovs, you can raise an army corps. Pakistan has pumped it in. Kalashnikovs do not grow, madam, on the apple orchards of Jammu and Kashmir. They have been sent in to destabilize and create a serious situation where the level of violence had gone completely beyond the police and the paramilitary forces. We were sent. We do not go there for tourism.
Okay. Let me just get you in, Mr. Rahman. Yes, there was a very, very tough time. And he's right. In 92, 93, you were there, you experienced it. I've been with you there those times. It was actually like a war zone. Now, you needed a certain amount of military presence to maintain India's hold in the Kashmir Valley. Today, is there a possibility for doing things slightly differently? I mean, obviously, you do have to have the army in large parts. You have to have the army there in Jammu and Kashmir. You know, it is a border area at the end of the day, just as you have to have the army in the northeast or Rajasthan or Gujarat or any other places. Is there an argument, in your view, to be made that at least when it comes to civilian-facing roles, you should have perhaps a better trained, better equipped Jammu and Kashmir police force or paramilitary forces raised from within the valley, which should be facing the civilians to a lot more, so that the army and any other paramilitary forces that are there should be more looking at purely counter-terrorism, counter-insurgency and border security aspects?
I think I agree with what you're saying. The army has to be in Kashmir. You cannot avoid it. Not for policing the state. The army has to be there because they have to guard the borders, both in the west as well as in the north and the east. Now, the problem is that when the army is in these forward areas, they have to have stations down below which will pass through the civilian areas, and their convoys will pass through the civilian areas. But I personally feel, because I'm a policeman, and I worked throughout the northeast and I worked in Kashmir. When I went to Kashmir in 93, the situation was extremely bad. There was only firing and nothing else. When you have to handle a situation like this, it is advisable not to put the army facing the civilians, if it is possible. And it is possible if you have well-trained police forces and very good leadership. One of the most important things in this country, as far as leadership is concerned, is that the public must have confidence that this leader is not taking sides. He is totally neutral. And he is infecting his own people with that neutralism. Once that is established, the public will have confidence in that force.
Okay.
It's very difficult for the army to understand this, because they are a force to defend the nation.
And it's not their job to be doing actually doing crowd management and dealing with stone pelters. It is not the job. It should never have been the job of the army to be doing
that. The army, you know, Vikram, does not want to be involved in such a task.
And I think that's what the army has been saying the last couple of weeks.
You know, we have been completely taken out of Srinagar because we insisted that we should be. We don't want to
get. But even the Handwara issue really came down to a bunker in the center of Handwara. It's not been demolished, but maybe it could have been.
You know. There is more to Handwara than meets the eye.
So, and that's, I mean, obviously it is a debatable issue. But rather, Kumar, part of what you and the other interlocutors were talking about was also part of this. And I failed to understand why over all these years we've not been able to really invest in building up 10, 20, 30, 40, 60 battalions of well-trained, well-equipped Jammu and Kashmir police forces trained in crowd control with the sort of equipment that you would see in a similar flashpoint in the west or somewhere. If you had that happening, maybe you wouldn't be having firings, you wouldn't be having 100 deaths like you did in 2010, or even 5 deaths as you've seen in the last month.
I think that point, Vikram, comes to a point that General Bakshi made earlier. Whether it's Haryana, whether it's other parts of the country, most recently Bengaluru, we see our public gathering, protesting, burning buses, looting buildings, destroying public property and assets. I would only argue that it's very important to be seen as having a even-handed, consistent policy across the country on that issue. You cannot.
But there is a difference. It's not the crowds in Bangalore. Others are not shouting anti-Indian slogans or saying "India, get out of here." That's not. So there is a difference at the end.
Well, actually, quite honestly,
I would say they're not throwing stones at a time when terrorists are. There's an encounter taking place between terrorists and the army, and they're throwing stones at the army. So
we'll come to that.
The two things are different.
We'll come to that phenomenon. But your first point about shouting slogans, I think the destruction of public assets is much worse than shouting slogans. I'm an old-fashioned person. I believe that sticks and stones will break my bones and words will not. And I would urge that the priorities be seen correctly in this audience as well as in our country. Okay. When it comes to radicalization, look, this is a global phenomenon. I think neither is Hamida right in saying that it's a response to military presence, nor would we be right to see it in isolation. This is happening amongst youth in all over the world today. It's not preventable in Birmingham, just as it's not
or
being
Brussels.
Prevented here, or Brussels, or London, or New York, or Washington, or Chechnya, or Moscow, or Beijing, or Xinjiang. It's a problem that has to be addressed with collective wisdom.
What was the recommendation that you as the ENDA interlocutors made on this specific point? And has it been acted upon?
One, on the army, we made 2 points. First, that there's very little knowledge that the army today is bound by the Supreme Court regulations on how they can operate even in counterterrorism situations. And those are actually quite stringent regulations for the protection of human rights. I believe that it's very important for the army to also go more public on this, that you are working under a completely changed
because
rubric
the perception
of
in the
operational
Kashmir, in the
behavior.
The perception in large parts of the Kashmir Valley is that the army and the other armed forces, the security forces, have a complete license to do whatever they want under AFSPA.
So that is not correct. That has been altered by the Supreme Court regulations.
Okay.
Second point on the policing point is that because of 20 years of insurgency and conflict, which was much reduced from the 2005-06 onwards, the police tended to be more intelligence gathering. Now they were put into, from 2008-09, the civilian tasks have been undertaken by JK police, not by army, not by CRPF.
The poorly trained and equipped JK police.
Most important is the equipment problem. They do not have water cannons. They do not have ways of keeping
pepper gas,
a distance.
No, there are lots of technology that exists right now.
Even a distance between armed police and civilian, they have no way of keeping this. And the final is that you have a vacuum at the political level.
Right.
When you talk about villagers and so on going and pelting stones, this is a slightly new phenomenon.
Yeah.
It has not been the case earlier.
Okay. Rao, let me get you in before I come to Ashok.
I'll take you back to 1989-90. The situation in Kashmir in 1989, in the early 90s, was explosive. There was an absolute collapse of civil and police administration. When Rubaiya Saeed kidnapping happened, when the government of India was asked to bend, it crawled. So obviously there was a lot of weakness in the system. But after 1990, the army took over and broke the back of militancy from 90s onwards. And it has done a fantastic job. But I think we have come to a stage now for many, many years, at least 5-6 years, when this fight of fighting terrorism should go to J&K police. The J&K police today is a professional police. It is extremely well trained. They've done some fantastic operations, intelligence-based operations. Nowhere, as Mr. Ramon would tell you, and that is the problem.
Fighting terrorism should be given to them or dealing with
dealing
security,
with
law and order, crowd control.
Both, inside valley,
Are they equipped to take
absolutely,
on?
Absolutely.
Better for intelligence, less good for civilian.
They have done so many operations that are fantastic operations, anti-terrorism operations, when militants are holed up in buildings. As Radha said, they have excellent intelligence inputs. They have moles within Lashkar, Jaish-e-Mohammed. They get intelligence on ground. The army must be getting it too, but as not as much as J&K police.
Okay. Can I just get you in on this? If you talk to any a group of people in the Kashmir Valley, they'll say that there is a license to kill that has been given to the security force, as you hear in large parts of the northeast as well. Is that really the case?
No, I think the situation in Kashmir has improved. But I think we ought to realize that taking away the army, replacing with the police is not the solution. We have the worst situation in Manipur, where Manipur police commandos kill more than the security forces, the central forces. I think what we have to realize is that the situation compared to the 1990s has dramatically improved.
That
and
is
now
no
we
doubt
have to
about.
Build upon it. If you cannot build upon if the security forces believe that they are beyond the reach of the law. That's happening in Kashmir, that's happening in Northeast, that happens even in Delhi. Now, if you look at the recent uprising, and if you look at the uprising in 2011, why did the uprising take place? Uprising took place against a series of human rights violations. Now, if the government had taken immediate steps in conformity with the law to ensure that nobody is treated above the law, and if you assuage the sentiment, then obviously you build the solidarity with the people.
But
and
in
that's
this case, but in this case, if we look at this particular case, there are differences in many cases. Yes, in 2010 there was a fake encounter charges that were there. In 2009 there was an attack on two women. But in this particular case, it was in a sense, or at least what seems to have come out, full investigation needs to be done. It was probably a fake report or a fake video which sparked the whole thing off. And as he said, there's some sort of a mystery around it because it's not necessarily Handwara, it's not one of the places which is normally that parts have not really been particularly prone to violence of this nature.
But then it's the responsibility of
Handwara is more, actually the violence in Handwara has more been in the hills and other places. This is the place from where the militants infiltrate. But in the city of Handwara, you're not quite at crowd.
No, I think we have to realize that if there is a misreporting, it can even take place as close to Delhi as in Dadri. Yeah. You know, if you do the investigation, you'll find out that there was no beef. No, that's not the issue. The issue is, I think we have to build a society based on the rule of law, and that's not happening.
I'd just like to inject a note of realism. Please see the problem on the ground. See the anatomy of the Handwara incident. They claim that a girl was molested. The girl herself says, nothing like this. It is these boys who misbehaved with me. You see, a lynch mob is assembled, stoning of an isolated bunker starts, then that bunker is surrounded and set on fire. What orders do you want me to give to my troops? You should quietly get burnt. Is that the order? Can you expect a commander to give this order to his troops? He is a human being. He has got the right to private self-defense. If the lady very rightly said, sticks and stones have been used.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
With stones you are going to burn a set of boys down in their bunker. So what do you expect them to do?
No, I think
the law has to be enforced. Nobody can take the law into his own hands. No. Let's also not, you know, a reflex reaction that the chief minister barges into the RM's office and says, sack these guys, arrest these guys. What orders do you want me to give to my boys next time? Look, if a mob surrounds you, hits you with stone, you are bleeding through your head, through your arm, your nose, and now they want to put you on fire, please stand quietly, bow your head and take it.
No, I think I think we have to realize that beyond this particular incident, there were cases where the security forces have used disproportionate force, sometimes knowingly, killing innocent civilians, which led to series of strikes. I am not saying in this case that, you know, the story is not correct. What I am saying is...
So hang on. Disproportionate force, you would agree with him that if disproportionate force is being used when it is not required, that is wrong. But do you agree with his point?
Obviously, you have to respond. Now, the question is, in many of the country, I mean, across the country, there is a case for using firearms. Now, when you use firearms, do you hit straight in the head or you hit below the belt?
So, that's where my point, and let me come to both of you now. And
can I just make one point on this? Here on the Handwara incident, that General Bakshi is describing, the critical point is that you do not generally allow a mob to come anywhere near a security installation. You have got to make your security installations in such a way that
let me now come to the political point
inside or defend it.
The search for an overall political situation is something that we need to look at. But Sambit and Tom, let me just come to both of you. Sambit, look at the way you see those pictures of those policemen. They're being attacked by crowds, being beaten up. They have no protection. If you look at crowd control as takes place even in Western Europe, and they don't have as many incidents, they've got shields, they've got helmets, they're better protected. They're less likely in that situation to panic and open fire because they have other equipment to use.
You're absolutely right. I mean, we should now have a police force which is well-trained, well-equipped, well-dressed. But what we have missed in this discussion are the enabling points or the clauses of AFSPA. The army or the force can enter into anyone's house without a warrant, number one. Second, any vehicle can be stopped and searched because of the suspicion that vehicle may be carrying terrorists or ammunition. If the police were to have all these rights, so what is the difference between the police and the army? Because all said and done, these are required because radical measures are taken in radical situations.
If there's a terrorist gang which has come inside, or there are terrorists in the hillsides around Handwara or in a particular forest, it has to be the army which goes in and does it. A local police force can't do it. But dealing with a crowd on the street somewhere should actually be local police, because also there are agent provocateurs which could be at work out here. It's much tougher for them to do it if they're local Kashmiri polices.
In fact, the answer to this lies in the history of AFSPA. If we visit the history of AFSPA, that is 1958 September, we would see what happened in Northeast. Assam Rifles were called in. The Assam Rifles fizzled out. And lo and behold, they held a false plebiscite. False plebiscite in India. And they formed a parallel government.
Yes.
And that is where army came in. Yes. Saved the country. Saved the Northeast province.
Absolutely. And that's what the army did in between 1990 to 95. That's what the army and the paramilitary forces did in the Kashmir Valley. And they did their job. But once they had done their job, the question is, do you need to have
How do you know the job is over? I'll give you an example. Vikram, look, this question
You're
has always been asked.
To the
that
army.
Now it is peaceful. Why is not the
army... I'm saying it's peaceful. It's
now the work has been done. You said the army has done its job. That means it has returned peace. So why not the army go off? This was the question.
No, that's...
Yes, let me answer.
The army was
let
sent
me
into
answer.
The streets
I get your
of Delhi in 1984, well, I, 2 days after
you,
the assassination
your question,
of Mrs. Gandhi.
Vikram,
at a certain point, the army was told not to return to the
barracks. The essence of question is, now that the situation is heading towards normalcy, why have the army there? The answer lies in what happened only last year in Tripura. The government in Tripura lifted off the AFSPA. And in fact, we saw what happened in Manipur. 18 jawans lost their life the very next day.
The question is, in Tripura you have no insurgency which is notified, you know, nobody has died in the last 1 year. The question is whether there is a need for security forces in terms of the central security forces.
But
it's
I
for
think,
the state government to decide.
I think Samit, the point you're missing is the answer sometimes in between. The solution is not to either say, oh, let's have no army in Jammu and Kashmir at all, or they should only be standing. Between that and saying that you should have a concentrated 60 battalions of the CRPF and large numbers of the army in cities and townships inside the valley. Between the two, there are possibly solutions somewhere in between.
No, definitely, even Buddha said that the in-between path, that's yes, Madhyam Marga, is the best marga. We should always follow that. But remember, radicalization does not follow the path of Buddha. When radicalization follows the extreme paths, naturally, we have to go in for ways which can contain radicalization.
But
that is what is important.
So you have to make sure that you are containing
radicalization. I cannot act a Buddha when the IS is sitting on my head.
I'll tell you what... certainly, if there were certain parts of the Kashmir Valley which tomorrow were to actually become returned to 1993, 1994, you had an actual ISIS, a village or two villages that would say, okay, this is now ISIS territory. Of course, you should send in the army. The question is, in other normal circumstances, are you more likely to have alienation? If you're constantly being checked and your ID card is being scanned and somebody from outside the state is asking you, why are you going here, why are you not going here? What would be the right balance in your view between having to have a certain presence of the army and the security forces to make sure terrorism does not return and militancy doesn't rise? What is the balance between that and ending daily frictional conflict?
Frisking is the mandate of the police. Getting arrest warrants from the magistrate is a mandate of the police. Stopping cars and vehicles in civilian areas is a mandate of the police. The very perception, the sense of hostility you get with army doing frisking in civilian areas, it's a battle of perceptions. Technicalities are not as important in these situations as perceptions. And the perception is that the apparatus in New Delhi views Kashmir as a hostile population. Until you view Kashmiris as a hostile population, equipment, crowd control mechanisms, and you know, non-lethal measures will only go so far. If you view Kashmiris as politically hostile, and there is an element of hostility in the valley, let's see the elephant in the room. There is an element of social sanctity for militancy. You have seen people attending funerals of militants. I think it is equally important that we talk about that. No amount of lethal versus non-lethal equipment debate can take our focus away from the very fact that politically there is a sense of disempowerment within Kashmir. We need to tackle that. The role of the army, the second part of your question, see, it's a more complex situation. The army is guarding the borders, but there is infiltration. Infiltration goes into the civilian areas. There are militancy-related activities in the city as well. But I think the J&K police has demonstrated that the inner ring of security, they're quite capable of maintaining. They have some of the best intelligence gathering mechanisms, I think, in the country. It is a professional police force. They've rendered numerous sacrifices, and they've worked with the security forces. The question is of trust. How long will we continue to deal with the civilian population in Kashmir, however hostile they are, operatively? When will we start dealing with them politically? Let's stop talking about the number of Kalashnikovs, the number of rounds that have been, recovered from militants. Let's also talk about how much the civilians have suffered. Unless and until there isn't a sense of redressal.
He's saying that it should be asked to the national conference. Why haven't you been able to deal with it politically? I mean, you have to answer it. Your government now.
I'll answer that. I was expecting
there's lack of leadership.
You asked a question. Let me answer.
You are putting the Bharatiya Janata Party in the middle.
Let me answer.
Who have come only for 6 months into leadership?
I didn't even name your party.
That's not the issue. You have. The issue is politicians cannot run away from the duties that they're supposed to perform, and if a politician is asking that the political duties have not been performed all these years, despite the fact that you have ruled the valley for most number of years. Naturally, as your opponent and as a citizen of this country, I'll ask you this question. Why did you not do your job well?
You couldn't be more wrong and off the mark here, Sambit, and I'll tell you why. Our sense of resolution, solution, our proposed solution is restoration of autonomy. In the year 2000, we passed the autonomy resolution in this legislative assembly by 2/3 majority. That is a legally elected constitutional body of the state under the constitution of this country, and it was sent to Delhi, and your home minister threw it in the trash bin. So what is the incentive to the man on the street? That the democracy has failed you, that the institutions of democracy have no credence or credibility in Delhi. Let us operatively manage you. A mainstream political party in Kashmir can do only so much. The political will and sagacity has to be shown by the ruling elite in New Delhi. You have to politically engage with our people. You can't keep talking
how convenient.
Talking about
politicians need to be shown the mirror. Did he shout the similar way towards their coalition partner? They were in coalition
with
the Congress.
I'm about to come to his
all
coalition
these years
partner.
There was a central Congress government. He should have shouted, blasted the Congress leadership.
Okay, it's not that the Congress. All right, fine. Let me ask you, Tom, the same question. At the end of the day, all of you as politicians. All of you as politicians.
Can I make a quick point? Can I please make a quick point? A very quick point. Sambit, let's rise about partisan debates in politics. I know you are on TV all day long, and you're in this mode of looking at everything.
No, Junaid, let me tell you one thing. All three of us, the three politicians because we represent a party. I'm not a Shahrukh Khan or Amir Khan that I'm representing a movie industry over here. I'm here because I am what I am because of my party. So I would speak the best interest of my party. That's
can
all.
Can I bring some peace to your brother? Praise your party.
Junaid, what's the broader point you were making on rising up politics?
The broader point, Sambit, is that we have a problem. 70,000 to 80,000 people have died. We have a problem. Let us see the elephant in the room. It cannot be solved militarily, operatively, or through this higher moral pedestal discourse that you are so used to, that everybody else is an anti-national. And, if we suggest something that is slightly different than what you believe to be nationalistic, we are traitors. We asked for the revocation of AFSPA from the Congress. Our coalition with them was as much as of an electoral compulsion as your alliance with the BJP, according to your own official stand.
Okay, fine.
We continue to ask for the revocation.
At some point, everyone has to sit down and figure out how are we going to find a political solution to Jammu and Kashmir. And this is something where you also failed in trying to find any answers.
See, specific questions have specific answers. There was a mention of radicalization. Radicalization is an international phenomenon, and this is an industry. I'm sorry to say this. This exists in the in my state, in northern states, and this has become an industry because it's flush with money. And the solution is, as Major General Bakshi mentioned, it is about employment. It is purely an economic interest that needs to be met.
No. Actually, can I just disagree a little bit with that? It's not as if Jammu and Kashmir is not one of the more prosperous states in the country. The levels of affluence are reasonably high. You go to Srinagar, you will be astonished at the amount of wealth that you see.
Vikram, affluence is one thing. Employment opportunity available to the young across the country is wanting, whether it was done in our period or
in the... Some of the most radicalized of people you will find in parts of South Kashmir, for example.
Yeah.
You go to Pulwama, you go to Thral, you go to some of these places. Yeah. Some of the most radicalized people you will find are people who actually have a job. Who have an employment. Yeah. They're reasonably well to do.
They're the mentors. They are the mentors. And who are seek?
Oh, you know, they are poor, so therefore they're radicalized.
Vikram, it's not about being poor or rich.
Or they don't have a job, so they're radicalized.
Come on.
Many, I mean, across the country.
A couple of engineers with really high-paying jobs, and you'll be horrified to hear what they have to say.
Vikram, they are the mentors. They are the people who lead these guys on the garden path. Now, let me talk about the other issues. You have the Jammu and Kashmir police in the cities. That is the urban areas. The hinterland is covered by the Rashtriya Rifles, which is a paramilitary force. Now, every time you gun for the military, you need to distinguish this is the Rashtriya Rifles, which is playing that role. Then followed with the army at the line of control. Now, since last 2 years, we have had 800 insurgencies. Across the border.
Infiltrations.
Now, if you say that the army has to be moved out of that place, and remember, when you deploy the army, you're also deploying the intelligence network. It takes years to build up that intelligence network. And that intelligence network, if you dismantle, then the casualties on the border and in Jammu and Kashmir is going to get heightened. So it is easy to say remove the army, but you need to address...
I don't think anybody is quite saying that. I don't think anyone is saying, yeah, take the army away, shut down and let's do what we did with, you know...
But then the other
option
is CRPF.
What IK Gujarat did with Roy in Pakistan. I don't think anyone is saying that. We are saying
CRPF
you should find a slightly more sensible way of how to handle law and order problems in the back.
Law and order problems is being handled, way, which but is not unfortunately, the, not army is getting a bad name.
Okay, let me get final thoughts from all of our panelists. And I'm just trying to get... You know, Kashmir is not a simple situation to try and find answers to. It is not. And maybe it's not going to be a simple answer. But maybe each of you, as we end the show, can come up with just in 10, 15 seconds, one or two immediate steps that you think the authorities and the government can take to try and make things a little better. Let me start with you, Professor Naeem.
There needs a national introspection of how to actually give Kashmiris, restore their sovereignty, resolve the issue so that we don't need all these discussions and debates which actually are very hurtful to all of us here. As long as you continue to manage the situation as it is and you make a discussion whether army is there or police, let me tell you that Kashmir sections of Kashmir police are an extension of Indian forces. They directly report to the Home Ministry of India and therefore they have no mercy for the Kashmiris. They are actually carrying the agenda
of the Indian state. So you don't want the police there either, just whom you think should be governing.
And therefore these discussions are useless. I request all of you to have an introspection, do soul searching and see how much Kashmiris have suffered. And you will only have a moral high ground if you address the issue wholeheartedly and holistically by resolving for all times to come.
All right.
Thank you.
Suhail Chakma, final quick thoughts from you.
Well, so long you accept the concept of the national state, you have to realize that the state shall have the power to deploy the security forces whatsoever. The key issue is while deploying the security forces, they have to respect the rule of law, human rights for everybody, which are non-negotiable. And the final point which I wanted to say is that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act is not the law which can manage the law and other situations in terms of the dialogue between the state and the central government reach to a situation. I mean, that's not the legal framework we should be following after 60 years.
All right. Radha, quick final thoughts from you.
In our interlocutor's report, we recommended that army camps and so on in civilian areas should be redeployed out. However, What we did say is that you have the capacity to create rapid reaction units that can go when required. Therefore, you do not require to be in every, you know, few hundred meters of this place. Second point, civilianization of the police. It's one thing talking about crowd control. That's a separate unit or problem altogether. But daily encounters, the police need to have their own dignity restored, and that community element of interface is very important.
Okay,
they should not be made a political game. Third, most important, which is a point that various people have raised, which is that you have to address the political issues.
Okay.
And may I say this to you too, that I have seen on television over and over debates and discussions on the security problems. Only 1% of debate is ever on the political issues, which is the key underlying issue.
All right, fair enough. Rahul.
I have a couple of points.
De-incentivize
conflict. Kashmir has become a cottage industry. Make sure that there are no interested parties in this conflict. The second thing you need to do is define this insaniyat ka daira. Insaniyat ka daira is to make sure that patribal doesn't happen, but insaniyat ka daira doesn't mean that village is coming to attack you while you are in the middle of a gun battle with terrorists. Make that clear.
Okay.
Army is to guard the borders, to fight infiltrators. As far as possible, army should not be brought in law and order situations, even if it is very serious. There are paramilitary forces who are very well trained to handle law and order situations.
And
they should be the line between the public and the government, not the army. The army is the line between the foreign attackers and the country. As far as possible, don't bring the army for law and order situations.
Okay, fair enough.
Let me present a different picture of army, because the army has been thrashed enough in the program today.
Actually, no one's thrashed the army. No one has thrashed the army.
I'm saying that the army be removed, saying that the army has
that.
No
one has said that.
Just a second. If you continue discussing and debating human rights, let us see the army.
If I am saying if somebody says don't use a Ferrari to pull a bullock car, it doesn't mean you're thrashing the Ferrari.
We have been, 2 years ago, when in fact Jammu and Kashmir was submerged by the deadly flood, it was the army, men of his cadre, men of his repute, who were down there. Up till this, they were in the water, they were saving people of Jammu and Kashmir. That is the real picture of army, sir. Even if the army has
taken this before,
madam, was I interjecting when you had your 30 seconds? When the army is seen with a gun, sir, it's not that the army wants to kill or wants to die. It is just because it wants to save Mother India's Kashmir. That is it.
But we get it. Sambit, but no one. Sambit. I'm still trying to figure out where is the debate in this. Nobody disagrees with anything that you said. The whole thing which you spent 45 minutes debating is whether absolutely you're right in everything that you said. But the question
I heard the professor, she said thank you and went off. What was she saying all this while? She was saying the whole human right has been devastated.
So
it's a doomsday. Nothing is there. We all are dead. And what was she saying? The army is killing us all.
All right, the professor doesn't represent. But I'm saying you said that everyone has spent 1 hour.
And then she said thank you and vanished.
She's still here.
So she may not agree with you, but I'm saying a real question is what you should be using the army for. Not to say that the army is not trying to defend Mother India. Obviously, no one's disagreeing with that. Okay, Tom.
Real problem is coming in from Pakistan. Pakistan is
such a big problem, we can't even finish it in 45
minutes. Yeah, I know. But then you need to address it. Because if you do not solve the problem at the Pakistani level, if this dispensation doesn't take care of sorting it out with Pakistan, this problem will continue.
Tom,
my problem,
if you have a solution to the problem of Pakistan, Mr. Modi, I'm sure, will be very happy to
appoint. We will consult. We are ready to give them advice. Let them ask for it.
Not only will Prime Minister Modi appoint you a special envoy, if you have the solution to Pakistan, Barack Obama could appoint you a special envoy.
The Congress Party will. The United Nations will appoint you special envoy. But there is a solution.
I have a solution to Pakistan. Here you are. The United Nations gives you a mandate.
Why didn't you address in the last 70 years?
How have you been able to address it for 70 years, as you rightly said?
No.
How have you handled Pakistan?
We need to address it. It's no way that you send
it. We all get it. How? Cancer is a big problem. How are we going to solve cancer?
You send a team from Pakistan to investigate.
He goes to Narendra Modi now.
And what do you do?
You don't. Sir, your team is not sent there.
I will go and take advice from Rahul Gandhi tonight. I'll ask him. Yes, no. And we will solve all the problems.
Rahul Gandhi coming in. You want to have an obsession with Rahul Gandhi.
You want to advise or Rahul wants to advise? Who
your obsession is you don't take care of the country.
Okay,
and
we digress.
We will take your advice.
We will find a solution to Pakistan if possible. Major General Bakshi.
The level of weaponization there has been so high that these normal law and order policing paradigms just break down. The British had it very good. They faced a non-violent resistance movement, Satyagraha and the rest of it. For God's sake, understand the level of lethality of the weapons that are floating around in that Kashmir. Junaid said a hostile population. I strongly disagree. The central tenet of our counter-insurgency operations is that the center of gravity of the operations is the people. If you have them with you, you can win. Information will come. Otherwise, I'm afraid you've had it. Now, practical solutions. You know, the thing that was suggested here is an Assam rifle type model of an indigenous force.
Yes.
Which will, you know, be the buffer between the army, yes, the police spectrum, end of the spectrum, and they would be the Assam rifle type force. The CRPF, which was the Crown Reserve Police Force, was for dealing with non-violent, peaceful Gandhian agitations in the British period, has now been made responsible for CI. Those poor boys are not structured, they are not trained, they don't have the ethos.
Absolutely.
So please train those boys, please structure those boys, equip those boys.
So you are,
they are the buffer.
Absolutely
correct. Recruit them locally. Absolutely. Why don't you do that?
Absolutely correct. So that's what the answer is that we should be looking for, and that's the answer that has come out. So there, Sambit, the Indian Army agrees with exactly what
he
said. No,
we take his advice and their advice as well.
All right. Good. All right. Last, final, very quick word from you, Junaid Matto.
It's time to address the political, political aspect of this problem more than the operative aspect of this problem. I will reiterate that. And let us get out of this T20 mode, you know. I think on a lighter note, I mean, it's good to end a debate on a light note. I think Sambit should limit his appearances on news debates on two or three a night, because I think he's getting things mixed up.
I do not mind that Omar Abdullah should limit his appearances on political scenarios. We would be very happy with that.
All right, thank you all so much for having joined us, given us some insight into what could be done. And I think the time has come to keep on trying new, different, innovative ways of handling the situation. If something is not quite working, we shouldn't be scared of innovating and trying something slightly different. And that, I think, is one of the major lessons that we've got from all of our experts today on the Big Fight. We'll be back again next week. Bye for now.